small volumes of anywhere, but there are ways of handling that, and the state can help in a variety of ways. Part of it through waste minimization, part of it through getting them in contact with proper facilities for handling this. What we're looking at really here is a situation where someone has passed the buck and who is happy to allow an intervening handler of the material to insulate them, or hope that it will insulate them from liability. That shouldn't be encouraged. There should be strong incentives against it. This material is nasty enough stuff and has the potential for hurting people to the extent that someone ought to be tracking this from cradle to grave. The generator, it seems to me, should not be able to say, well, golly, we passed it on to a common carrier, golly, we passed it on to somebody else, we don't have any more responsibility. If it was generated and it has the characteristics that we're talking about, someone needs to be taking responsibility. And that's why this bill attempts to fix that in a way that is as rational as we can make it. Yes, there's always a circumstance where you can imagine someone operating in good faith who passes the material on to someone else who spills it. But unless we have that responsibility clearly roosting somewhere, it seems to me that there are just too many loopholes for some pretty nasty stuff to be oozing around.
Representative Pierce?
Thank you. Two questions. Back to page 1, line 29 through page 2, line 4. Hypothetically, if I own land, say in Kotzebue, and am signing a construction contract with a company to build something there, and in the course of building that, some hazardous materials are going to be used, do I fit under this section 4 because I have signed a contract with someone to build something that inherently is going to have to use a hazardous substance in that building process? If that person then buys a hazardous substance, puts it on a carrier, takes it out, and somewhere along the line there's a spill, am I responsible for it? Because I have, by contract, arranged for the transport or the storage or the disposal of that material inherently by the fact that that material is going to be used.
Let me see if I understand the question. The hypothetical contract that you have signed is to construct a building.
Something.
Yeah.
Any activity.
Rather than a contract specifically to transport, store, dispose of, or treat particular material.
Except that in building that building or doing whatever activity it is, hazardous substance has to be used or will be used.
Well, the real question is whether, as the landowner, you own or control the substance. If your role was really solely to hire a contractor to build a facility there, and then that person transported the materials off or arranged for transport to another place where it was built, I believe you probably would not be considered as having owned or controlled it, whereas the contractor would. On the other hand, if you were acting as your own contractor, use the materials yourself and actually control it, then you would like to be covered by that section.
But I'm not covered if I am not acting as my own subcontractor.
I believe that's correct.
I believe that's correct. Okay, second question.
Denny, are you all working with DNR on redoing their leases? I've looked at the actual lease points that they used specifically in Danvers. And we've got 20-year leases and 30-year leases, and they're definitely not very tight. Are you working with the Department of Natural Resources to make sure that at least in the future, we make some changes in those leases?
We have been talking with DNR about the problem, and I don't know whether Jerry Brasi is still here. He was here a moment ago. He would probably, I know he didn't come to testify, but he would be a good one to respond. As you know, Representative Pierce, from your experience up there, many of the North Slope oil field service related facilities that are on state leaseholds, and their DNR's leasing authority, its bonding capacity, authority, and its ability to manage those leases is a key factor. DEC does not have authority to require bond, and
yeah,
I realize you know that.
I know you mentioned, have you made any recommendations to them for future practices?
We have been talking with them out of our northern regional office, and let me defer to Jerry. I know he's back here and being surprised by this question. Jerry, the question that was raised is whether in our discussions with DNR about the leases on the North Slope, on the
well,
support leases.
Well, any state land, but specifically.
Sure. The Child Site, of course, is a useful example. Whether there are some changes in the approach that DNR wants to use.
Jerry, do you want to state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Jerry Brassi. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Northern Regional Manager for the Division of Land and Water Management. And in about 1974, the Department of Natural Resources sold at an outcry auction about 76 lease tracts in and around the Dead Horse area. I believe that those are the leases that Commissioner Kelso was referring to. And at that time, those lease tracts, which varied in size from approximately 2 to 5 acres, were leased for 55 years. And they had a set of various terms and conditions on them. One of the terms that you're referring to is in regards to solid waste. And as everyone's aware, in 1974, there were very few environmental laws and things that were passed that addressed hazardous waste. I think the Resource Conservation Recovery Act didn't happen until 1976 or 77. So it was prior to RCRA. And at that time, the DNR lease term of interest is that the tracks would be kept neat, clean, and tidy. I'm paraphrasing, but it's similar to that. It does not have any detail regarding how hazardous waste would be kept or disposed of or transferred. And as far as the second part of your question, Commissioner, we're in sort of a contract situation. It takes two parties to amend that contract. Of the original 76, I think about 63 or 4 of them are currently occupied by the original leaseholders or reassignments. And we can't, at least in our opinion, unilaterally amend those contracts. There may be another approach that we can use. And this spring, what we're planning on doing is trying to, each one of the lease tracts requires a development plan. And we're in the process of writing each one of the leaseholders and requesting an updated development plan. And the development plan is a term and condition of the lease tract as well. And so we will take a look at each tract to see whether or not they're currently using the tract in the same manner that the development plan is supposed to conform with. For example, the Child's tract that you mentioned earlier was supposedly for a store, as you mentioned, and also for a cement plant. So there's no way that we could really bond it for a hazardous waste field. But if the development plan changes, then I think there may be, and we'll have to consult with the attorneys, but I think there may be a mechanism to reassess the bonding on those tracks. And I might close with saying that in 1974, we had a real hard time getting any type of bond on those tracks. And $20,000 bond was, we were doing well to get that. A large outcry by the support communities that bonds were not available in the state and that they had in many cases to put up certificates of deposit with the state as essentially a second on that deposit. So in the Child's case, he didn't really have a bond. He had a certificate of deposit with the state named, which in the long run becomes, as I understand it, an asset in the bankruptcy proceedings.
We've got another bill to take care of that.
Are you through, Representative?
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Moore.
I have a hypothetical question that I'd like to ask. What happens if the person who's responsible for generating the hazardous material turns it over to a bona fide, permitted person to dispose of, and then that person transfers it to another person in Eagle River, and that leaks into the water table? Who's responsible? I mean, who is liable in that case?
If I understand the situation correctly, when you get that second transfer to Party C, then Party A is finally out of it. Because Party A has done all that he could in transferring it to a responsible Party B. Party B is down the hook, however.
Okay, then, and then what assurances do we have either in the bill or in statute that to determine what a responsible party is? I mean, if the person who is handling the material doesn't have the resources to clean it up, if it becomes a problem, I don't care how many times you transfer it, someone has got to pay for it, for that responsibility. And that's the problem in what we're trying to do in our how we focus on hazardous waste problem is, bottom line is, somebody's got to pay for it. Either the producers of it, the people who generate it, or the state eventually.
And if things are working the way they should under federal law, then the Party C, the person who got it, should have, because they're required to have financial responsibility, insurance, bonding, or something that should enable them to take care of it. And if that person doesn't, if for whatever reason they're not complying with the law, don't have the financial responsibility, or a fly-by-night outfit, whatever, then Party B remains on the hook, because Party B had the responsibility to verify what kind of a character he was transferring the stuff to.
And are they required to have several million dollars worth of bonding?
I don't know what the amount is.
See, what I'm getting at is, it doesn't matter how many times you transfer it, if the problem comes up, somebody's got to pay for it. And what ends up happening in a lot of cases is the state or some other government entity ends up paying for it.
You will have situations like that, beyond a doubt.
And to your comment about if everything works as it's supposed to, if everything worked as it was supposed to, we wouldn't have a problem. But it doesn't. We have a problem on the Kenai Peninsula that the borough is currently cleaning up. The operator of the hazardous waste facility there was appropriately named this company Alaska Environmental Industries, and the borough is now cleaning that up, I believe. And
the point of a scheme like this, which maximizes the number of people who can be held liable, is to make sure that there are a maximum number of people who have the incentive to make sure that everywhere along the stream, the material is handled properly, which includes handled by people with the capability of not only disposing properly, but having the financial wherewithal to deal with an accident. Every time you have increased the number of people who could be held liable, you increase the likelihood that an accident will not happen.
Okay, I appreciate that. Could you give me a copy of just what the requirements are for showing financial capability of taking care of a problem if you're going to handle the hazardous material?
I'll be happy to get whatever we can glean from the requirements under federal law. I want to be careful that we don't lapse into talking about hazardous waste under the Federal Resource Conservation and Recovery Act as the only thing here. That would be, I know you're not suggesting that, Representative Barr. Hazardous substances, things that are potentially dangerous to people, include materials that are beyond what is required for handling in a certain way under the federal RCRA. I just wanted to mention that generally, and yes, we'll be happy to come in with more specifics about how the federal provisions work.
Okay, how about the state provisions? We can be more stringent than the federal provisions.
You mean in terms of liability?
Right, in terms of showing financial capability in order to take care of the problem.
I believe that our present approach is to, in regulations, is to adopt the same limits that are in the federal law.
Okay, I'd be interested in what those are. We can't.
Just on that point, Madam Chairman, I would say I don't think the state can be more strict in the sense it's an interference with interstate commerce, and you're going to run into a federal preemption argument. It's the same thing when we tried to require double bottom ships, oil tankers to come in through Prince William Sound. We ran into a federal preemption issue that said, no, you can't stop Liberian rust buckets from coming in here. So I think on a financial basis, you're going to run into some problems there, just on a preemption argument.
I'd be interested in exploring that anyhow. Also, I think that the fact that we are going to see problems arise where we're not going to be able to find or recover from the person who is responsible, that just adds, momentum to my drive to put more money in the hazardous waste response fund so that we can clean up problems when they come up, when we don't know or can't find out who's responsible. Then that falls to the government to take care of that, and we don't do a good job of it now. We are inadequately funded, and I'd just like to see us address that in a more positive manner, I guess.
Taxes.
Absolutely.
Representative Springer?
Thank you. Those pictures I just seen make me happy, Matt, not from the standpoint what the pictures show, but the case that's involved. That looks like the average Alaskan village. It looks like the average Alaska maintenance station. It looks like the average Alaska city dump. And nothing's done. The biggest violator we have is the government itself, a federal, state, and municipal government. The only reason we're making a case here is because industry is involved and they're bad guys. The only case we're picking on it is because it's up on the North Slope. Excuse me. And that's a big fashionable item to pick around on there. Nothing is done. You know how much we've been screaming about village waste. That involves directly people. You go to Hoover Bay, you see that picture 15 times all around the village, all around the houses. And that involves a much more threatening situation than in an industrial area like that. And I don't mean they don't excuse me. I don't think they should get away with it. That's not the case. But I can give you a good typical example how government violates the laws. A few years ago, the Army had surplus asphalt at Gamble. They wanted to get rid of it, and for whatever purpose. So they gave first preference to native corporations or state government. We had some use for it. What they didn't tell us exactly how old it was, they put any disclaimer on it as to quality or something. I got out of the budget some money because we needed asphalt bad in Nome. We carried it over. Ultimately, we found out that it had deteriorated to the point you couldn't determine the flash point on it anymore. It became a safety hazard to use it because the paraffin had separated out. The Army didn't want it back. They were glad that they found a sucker to take it. We couldn't use it because it was hazardous to use it from a safety standpoint. I got together with DEC and the people and says, what are we going to do? The barrels are very old too, so we couldn't handle it much more. They gave me a $45,000 scheme how to dispose of it by pouring concrete on the ground, lining it with visqueen and all the type of stuff and covering it up. They wouldn't let it burn and so on. And I'm sure it was within the existing regulations and laws what to do with it. It was economically not feasible. The state didn't provide the budgetary funds to do anything with it other than just to let the problem sit there. I said, the hell is that jazz? And I offered it to the city. And the city, of course, was leery in order to camouflage it a little bit, and they didn't want to take a gift. I told it I'd sell them to them for $1 a barrel. Well, they fell for it because they thought it was a really a good deal. Well, the city found out that they couldn't do a damn thing with it. They kept quiet. They gave it to their utility people. And the utility people, they said, holy Christ, what did we get into? And it ended up in the Nome city dump. And that's where it's at. You know. Now here's a good example. So I'm going to get off the examples, but my question is government covered with that thing? Because they are pretty damn slick about that paragraph 4 down there, passing it on to some innocent bystander who thinks he gets a good deal. And I was a successful bidder on some yellow Air Force paint one time that was 15 years old and you couldn't paint with anyone. I'm not going to tell you what I did with it. But that is another case how government... The government operates and passes, say, the liability on. We're always seeing here a person. Does that indicate government is not covered?
Government is a person.
It's a person.
That's right.
but you can't identify.
Not only because of this, also in oil and gas lease situations, because we're the landowner too, and the landowner may have liability in particular situations.
Then we better put that $1 billion fiscal note to that bill, because I think that only scratches the surface. And thank you. I have one other question in regards to what Representative Navarre had and also Representative Cotton. And that the crux of the thing is we're trying to address a fly-by-night outfits or for non-responsible people. And the security or bonding aspect is a big thing with me, because even if we said law, we identify the liable party, what good is it if you can't milk the cow? Especially the fly-by-nighters, they are notoriously having no assets that are attachable in any way, shape, or form. So how are we going to put some teeth in a law to be able not only to identify the bad boys, but to make them pay?
Well, other than normal policing-type activity, just having field people who can see when a problem is developing, this bill would create an incentive that all the people who might be tempted to supply hazardous substances to a midnight dumper to make sure that guy has adequate bonding, has all the licenses and permits that he needs, because if he doesn't, and if he spills and then takes a powder, then the person who gave the material to them is going to be paying the bill. So the more people who have an incentive to make sure that the ultimate disposer is on the up and up, the more likely it is that the midnight dumper, the irresponsible ones, will be excluded from that particular market.
I have to have a follow-up question on that, because and that's the point about adequate bonding. I think one of the underlying things was, and difficulty in it is simply the magnitude of the monetary expression of damage that's usually involved with those type of deals, like groundwater pollution or something like that. It's extremely costly if you want to do something about it. And I also know that it is economically prohibitive to carry, let's say, a $5 million bond or something on a small-scale operation. How are we going to bring the two together, the economic equilibrium from a standpoint what is prudent for cost in a specific project in relationship to the damage that and the corresponding amount of money that's necessary to fix the damage? Has any thought been given to that?
I believe that in creating this financial responsibility requirements, the federal government gave a good deal of thought to it. Now, whether they came up with the right formulas in the end, the right amounts for particular sizes of businesses or activities, I don't know.
But, you know, part of the problem with us is that Alaska is remote, and the biggest problems I have seen, again, are in the remote parts of Alaska. And it's simply an economic deal. You pay 50 cents or a dollar a pound to get some oil out for a crankcase in a snow machine or in a three-wheeler or whatever, and when it's used up, nobody is going to pay a dollar a pound to ship it back out, especially if it's useless material. And we haven't found really a practical solution for those small scale things, and that's where violations continuously occur, because obviously the DEC people don't have the money and the staff to be in those lesser populated remote areas of the state. And that's why those horrible situations exist out there. Things that are allowed in Nome, nobody would even think to allow in Anchorage or in the Kenai, and vice versa, things that appear in Shishmaref or in Wales or something, nobody would think getting away in Nome. It's a horrible situation out there. And we make big examples out of that deal, but I really have to think in relation to that law, what it does for those places out there. What is going to happen? Are all those people going to get fined? How are you going to determine a culprit? And Commissioner Kelso knows very well the case with the leaking fuel there in Nome. We spend a half $1 million just on the investigative portion, not on the remedy portion, just on the investigative enforcement, and there is every incentive for a violator like that to declare bankruptcy just in, as a case, on a one-case basis like that, because even if he wanted to buy bonding or insurance, it's not available. He can't get it, even if he's willing to pay for it. So I have great concern about the same sections that Representative Cotton was quoting. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I speak to that briefly? I'd like to emphasize that we don't see this bill as adding a new layer of financial responsibility. We see it as clarifying where that responsibility, the lines of that responsibility, where they run, and removing any potential ambiguity so that there is no incentive to try to pass the buck to somebody else trying to avoid liability when someone who was in a position to arrange for proper disposal and who had a appropriate relationship with that material as it moved along the stream from use through disposition. We want to make sure that there really is an incentive for those people to behave responsibly. So responsible operators do have means of having those materials taken care of, and they normally do that as a routine part of their business. So I would disagree that this is directed in any way at industry, although it is directed at those operators who might be tempted to behave in a less than responsible way. There are many good operators, and they handle this stuff. You don't hear about them because they handle it appropriately. And we work with them all the time, so we know that there are people handling this stuff effectively. I think, Representative Springer, you know from our earlier discussions that I feel very strongly that solid waste problems in rural Alaska are serious. They've not been adequately addressed. As you know, we don't have the funding to do an adequate solid waste program in rural Alaska. And it is a painful irony, I think, that in many communities that are far removed from industrial centers, there are nevertheless serious disposal problems. And Hooper Bay is a perfect example. We have a panoramic photograph of the dump at Hooper Bay and the problems that are involved there. But Hooper Bay is not alone, as you point out. I would not want the committee to think that we are oblivious to those problems, but I don't think that all of the solid waste problems that exist in the state can be addressed in a single vehicle. This particular vehicle really is designed to make sure that we reduce the incentive to try to get out from under the burden of having the stuff handled properly when it's generated by someone who's in a position to have it taken care of. And secondly, to make sure that landowners who might receive this stuff take a careful look. It doesn't have to be a great deal more complicated than that. If there are areas where the committee is concerned that there might be either ambiguity in the language or that the lines of responsibility might wrap around someone who ought not to be drawn in, then we would be happy to work with the committee sponsor. And I'm sure I can speak for Doug in saying he would be happy to do that as well. And we can come back with something that fits more specifically if you would like. But it would be helpful to us to know if the general thrust that we're trying to accomplish here and that the sponsor has attempted to write down on paper is a direction that you'd like to go. If you need us to work and fine-tune it, that's certainly something we're available to you for.
At this time, I'd like to mention to the teleconference participants that we won't be getting to public testimony today, and I apologize for that, but we will have additional teleconferences on this bill. For now, I'd like to get to Representative Cotton and Sundin and Rydell.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I passed out that bill there. Nothing's going to happen on that today, but one of the sponsors wanted to get a draft to the committee members. The question I had had to do with something that Representative Sun brought up. The first line of the bill says, notwithstanding any other provision of law. And I'm wondering if that means, that the existing tort law, like the joint and several rules, would not apply. The way I understand it right now, if Party A passes the container to Party B, and then really that's his only activity, it was safe at that point, it wasn't a midnight dump. Party C goes off and becomes a negligent person, or Party B, I guess. So the court, under normal rules, would say, okay, you are 5% liable, and under the rules, that means that I have to pay 10% of the cost. Does this notwithstanding say that I could have to pay the whole bill?
I wish that language weren't there because it is ambiguous. I think that as it would not alter the provisions of the joint civil liability statute because it can be read as being not being in conflict with them. A person who is sued under the statute would have strict liability, that is, the plaintiff would not have to show fault or negligence. And if they only sued one person among several who might be liable, then that person would have to pay the whole bill unless he in turn brought in other potentially liable parties and tried to get them to bear a share of it. If there were several defendants, one way or another, if there were several of them, the plaintiff would not have to prove fault, but then the defendants among themselves would look at fault, and under the comparative negligence statutes, the court would apportion the payment of damages.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would just offer that's one interpretation of that language. I'm not sure that's exactly how it comes out. How about a couple of, I have the same feeling as Representative Springer has on the bonding insurance, performance bonds. I don't think any of them are available, or if they are, they're excessively expensive. So we've really wrapped out all small operators in this field. But what about the ongoing I buy a piece of property routine, right? And a couple of years later, I find PCBs buried. You know, the prior owner buried the PCBs or buried some hazardous waste in the property. There's the New England fish plant in Cordova routine where underground oil storage tanks start seeping up. That instance, who's liable? And secondly, if I own property and I sell it, I guess, am I liable for any subsequent discoveries of hazardous waste on that property? I don't know.
This is a place where there is a difference between this bill and the federal Superfund law. Under this bill, the person who buys property and then discovers that there was a discharge there, it's mm-hmm. now creating a problem, is stuck. That person is among the liable parties.
Under the purchaser or the seller?
Actually, both of them. The purchaser in the federal scheme has an opportunity to escape liability if he can show that he had no reason to think that there was hazardous materials there and that he actually undertook a reasonable inquiry about past uses of the property and didn't discover anything that would make him think that there was a problem.
Would a blanket condition in the deed take care of that? I mean, do we have to start putting these phrases in our statutory deeds now that the seller warrants that there are no...
It's already become standard practice with property warranties of no knowledge of hazardous materials on the site. It's already happened.
Okay, so if they are found, then the buyer's stuck and the seller's off because unless the buyer can prove the seller lied when he warrantied the... It would be a breach of warranty then.
Yeah, that's right. And this assumes that the seller was not himself responsible for this bill.
So from a purchaser's point of view, you want to put something in there to make sure that the guy has to at least warrant that the property's clean. So you have a breach of warranty argument going backwards.
That's right.
But you could get into Representative Springer's point that the whole property, you just give it back, cancel his contract, get his money back, and the cost of cleaning up are way beyond that anyhow, so big deal.
That has happened time and again in the lower 48.
So can a seller disclaim his responsibility in any way?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. We'll have this bill back before us, and thank you for your testimony today. Nothing further to come before the committee.
Well, I'm sorry, I missed it. The earlier stuff on 347. Yeah,
see much of the kids.
The kids should have been given a special area.
I don't know on any rational basis. But my problem is that was the protection and the
the exclusive right, equal protection right, you know, it says if you're going to discriminate, you've got to have some rational basis for discrimination.
The older people, I can see.
Well, there might be some equal basis there.
They're doing that down in Washington, did you read about that? Right? This one special area scout got a bill through that, created an exclusive area for senior citizens. And everybody else was mad because they wanted, that meant that a lot of people came to that area and helped that community's economy. I think that's where Jim senior citizens would be.
So, yeah, what's the purpose though, right? I mean, what's the rational basis? I don't think it's a good...
What did she say? Nobody said that, I didn't say it.
No.
I just didn't know much about the bill, and I had not agreed with it.
I'm not necessarily opposed, I'm just saying that what's the rational basis? The court says, well, under rights like voting and travel, there's a strict scrutiny test. And if it's not a basic right, then there's just a rational basis test. Is there some rational basis for making this discrimination? Maybe there is.
What did she say, though? She said that just existing Jews were the one to get this.
Yeah, it's just a unilaterally issue.
What's going on?
They closed down the commercial fishery, and somehow they couldn't open the sport fishery, and everybody went down to the river, and they couldn't fish.
They couldn't open the sport fishery?
I don't know. I didn't... Everybody here seemed to know what the unilaterally issue was, and I wasn't really up on it.
I don't know either. What is the unilaterally issue?
This is aimed at single parents. With a mother's working, she's got no time.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that was probably nice to check out.
What about us little kids? You know, we kind of need a place to be. Without having our
all it does though, one thing, I mean, what it does is it doesn't set up this area, it just authorizes or if in their great infinite wisdom they
I just read about that in the paper. They did one of these in Virginia, Washington, Oregon, and a woman in the legislature got her a place in her district. The legislature designated to help the citizens. And bingo, the economy of that area jumped right up because people from all over the country are coming there. So the rest of the legislature didn't have to get in. Why? What are you going to put on? Is it for this afternoon? When? What's going on at noon? Oh, for that. Okay.
Yeah.
On a tourist bill.
Sam, I'll try to find out. I should know.
I told her more about it. She wanted to move it out, and Al had it tentatively scheduled for this. I missed the other meeting we had.
Yeah, the other meeting we didn't have a quorum.
It came up, well, we had a discussion about it here too, and
no.
Probably
I didn't talk about it, so I was not aware.
Again, that's why we had an appeal on the first. She said she'll be back, you know, not far away. They didn't want to answer.
Well, that's great to be able to tentatively schedule a bill.
Well, we never do it as a big problem.
Oh, right. I just mean that that's, you know, if I was chairman of finance, I'd schedule my bills pending passing out of the committee.
They've done it 2 weeks.
Shockey, you know, Sam with Megan, he was with EPA, and he likes, I think it would be good for the test.
So once you notify me, I'll come and get it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's okay, you haven't had a problem.
I don't need to take a vacation.
Your parents is Juno, right?
Thank you.
That means that if you don't.
And that would depend on.
Who was on telecom today?
Bunch of different names for you.
I just think he'd be a good testimony along with Denny.
No, it'd be helpful hearing.
Mike, do you want to talk to me?
And before, I don't know what to say, but I like that.
I know. No. I had actually.
Steve Dwar could have clarified some of that. I hate mergers, I'll shut down this responsibility by A, B, and C, and D. I do have a question on the.
You're gonna vote, so I have to stand, that's why I'm not just doing it.
That storage facility.
Read this scale. This is 423, oh, actually, I was gonna ask for that.
That's my question, Jennifer. No, I didn't ask that.
But I wanna know, Chuck, you have where's the mini coming from?
But it seems like we've gotta be something. You say that the sites have to have, what'd you call them?